Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, my name is Gary Mansfield, and this is the Ministry of Arts podcast, where each week I'll be speaking to a different artist. Now let's begin by bagging these bongos. Hello, 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 and welcome to episode 182 of the Ministry of Arts podcast. 182, you'd think I'd get the hang of it by now, wouldn't you? Well, this week we have another artist from the Kensington and Chelsea Art Trail, whose most recent work can be found on the streets of High Street, Kensington. And it is the absolutely marvellous Richard McNess. Now, in this episode, there will be a bit of echo on Richard's end. There's a few factors that cause this. One, it's a fairly new studio, and Richard hasn't had a chance to sort of fill it yet, as it were. And two, because Richard makes fairly large artworks, he needs a fairly large studio. And I would say, after 182 episodes, that Richard's studio is by far the biggest studio that I've ever encountered. Now, it was recorded over Zoom, so I couldn't get the full scale of it. Now, I've done enough Zooms to take a fairly good guess how far away the wall is that's behind the person. And I'm fairly certain Richard's has got a different postcode. But as Richard makes clear, it's not in London, so the price per square metre is hell of a lot less. But in this episode, we speak about Portsmouth, New York, Old York, which is where his studio is, and, of course, his work that is placed in High Street, Kensington, as part of the Kensington Chelsea Art Trail. And as I've mentioned several times before, I'm not going to give any input into the artist's work because they could do it much better than me. So please, come and join me over Zoom as I spoke to Richard McNess.
I've been looking for a new studio because I've been using a space inside the building where I make other things for money. It's commercial space.
Yeah.
Obviously, you can't. Well, I don't know many people who make a living out of art.
No.
Face it. So, having done sculpture, I learned about mold making, quite a lot of practical skills. And whether it's good or bad, you end up using them to make money.
Yeah.
Some people get diverted and that's what their life becomes, technical stuff. For me, I managed to do a little conjuring trick where I can make stuff for money and I can sell that, and then I can also do my own stuff. So my old space was where I borrowed a bit of the studio where we do concrete plant containers and furniture. And over the which is something I started doing about 20 odd years ago when basically I had no money. I needed to get out of London because my kids, I wanted to get them out of Hackney. And at the time, Hackney was quite a troubled place. They're getting a lot of hassle. And
year was that, Richard?
Pardon?
What year was that?
That would have been about 2000. Just after the millennium, actually, yeah. So my kids are in the 28 and 31 now, so that problem doesn't really exist. So what we did, actually, we rented out our little house in Hackney, thinking, oh, we'll come back when the kids have grown up. And because I didn't want to leave London, actually. I mean, I'm from Yorkshire. I'm from York, which is where I am now. But I wanted to give them a chance to have some of what I had, you know. That was the countryside, playing down by the river and setting fire to things and that sort of stuff, you know.
Brilliant.
So it was a big decision because a lot of people, they leave London and they just move just outside London. I didn't want to do that. I thought, let's be generous. Let's go big, you know. So we went 200 miles up the M1. And, it wasn't easy, I'll have to be honest with you. But the great benefit is that you suddenly realise how what in London is so difficult, finding space to make things, constantly getting moved out of Waterloo, where we had a big studio, then we moved to Shoreditch in the early 80s. I worked in Shoreditch and I guess got a first space there in 1981 or two, I think. So before the Bricklayers Arms was a pub. We had to talk them to open on a Saturday evening just so we could have parties, you know.
Brilliant, brilliant.
So it was completely dead and it was cheap as chips. So me and five other guys had a space on Charlotte Road and later on Rivington Street. My girlfriend had at the time, my wife now, had a place on Hoxton Square. You know, it was...
It's hard even to think now,
insane.
Isn't it?
Insane. You know, you go there now and you think, I can't, it's like a dream. What happened? You know, but so when I left London, it was leaving a lot of good things behind. But the studio I had in Dalston at the time, again, it's sold again. You know, shit, you know, how many times do I have to move? just because the developers have caught up with us again.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I thought, right, I'm either going to have to stop bothering making sculpture or I have to get real about this and put my ego away, like the London thing, you know, if you're not in London, you're nobody. And I thought, no, I don't accept that. I'm going to go far away as I possibly can. And the benefit has been this sort of space, you know, it's having had that space I just described earlier, which is my previous studio.
Yeah.
The business that sort of grew out of just an idea of how do we feed ourselves or make plant containers because I like plants, I like gardens. It's something I can do. I know how to use concrete, learned how to use concrete at college. And so I thought, well, that went much better than I had any right to expect. Pretty soon I had other people working, helping me, you know.
Yeah,
it was fun. But I always wanted to, all right, you guys do that. And I'm just going to go over here and do this, you know. So I wasn't very good at it. I was always a bit distracted. Long story short, they turned out to be much better at it without me.
You was a hindrance.
I was a nuisance.
You was a hindrance to your own success.
Exactly. I was in my own way. So I just let them get on with it. And bless them, they said, all right, well, you do that, we'll do this, and we'll all make money out of it, and we can all live, you know. So that's how it's been.
And is that still going now?
Well, it is, and I mean, like I say, I've had a great year because the people that work with me, we all had a bit of a talk about it and said, look, I've got to get away from this because I'm in your way, and B, I really have other things I need to do. So they agreed to buy this thing off from me. And that enabled me to get this space.
Wow.
I don't have very much money to do anything in it.
Yeah, you've skimped yourself by it.
But, problem.
Yeah.
But it's not a bad problem to have, you know. So, yeah, so that here I am in this fantastic industrial space, which I'm fixing up at the moment. And I'm so lucky that I actually can't be kicked out of this one.
Excellent.
It's mine. So I feel really good about that. And I will be having a party, Gary. And mate, yeah. You will be invited.
But not in the Bricklayer's Arms.
Not in the Bricklayer's Arms. We'll have to build our own pub, I think. Yeah, so it's been interesting. So,
I mean, you were well ahead of your time because people now are moving a county away from London, aren't they, at least? Yeah.
I mean, it's funny because I grew up in the north, so it's nothing strange about it.
No.
It's, I must say, though, when I first moved to London when I was about 21, after college, the London accent, I found it very hard to understand. Yeah, it was just grated on me slightly.
Yeah.
And I go home to Yorkshire and I felt much more at home. Anyway, after 20, 25, 30 years, you know, the London accent to me, it's like home. I'm not kidding. I feel quite happy when I'm in London and I hear the London sound, you know. And it was really funny coming up here because I suddenly felt it felt odd, you know, it's like a younger me.
Yeah.
But I think the place you hold most dearly is the way where you actually grow up as an adult.
Yeah.
You got your childhood memories and your adult memories. And for me, London is like where I sort of came of age. So I do have a huge affection for London. In fact, when we left London, we rented out our little house. And Hackney being what it is, the solicitor, when we bought that house, said to me, got two kids, you know, he said, I strongly recommend you don't buy this house. It's a troubled neighbourhood, you know. So, what else am I going to do, you know? We'd lived in Bethnal Green and it was a tiny, tiny little house. So we need one more bedroom and I can't. So Hackney. And anyway, a few years later when we finally sold that house, the solicitor, a different guy, says, I strongly advise you not to sell this house.
Yeah.
A gold mine. it's something... very tricky about that, but what we did was when we sold that house, we managed to keep it. Gone up a lot in value from being pretty one of the cheapest places to live in London to being quite sought after.
So
we took that money, we bought a small flat near where my kids went to school, and that little toehold is great because my sons both share it now.
Brilliant.
They moved down to London, they both work at home, and they one's in music, the other one's an animator. So it's like the curse of the werewolf, you know, the arts. It just goes
in the blood.
I warn them. Don't do it. But we try to get them interested in maths and stuff. They were interested.
So, superb. Yeah. But it's good that they've got a little bolt hole in London because they wouldn't be able to bloody afford the rent otherwise, would they?
Unless they're extremely successful. The idea of... Well, when Ned first left college, he went to Kingston to do animation. He rented a place in the Elephant and Castle, and it was 600 quid a month, and it was literally a tiny room in a shared house. And it was, as for what it was damp, and it was, I thought, it's just so horrible, you know. He's just left college, he's trying to stick to London, and it's such a rip-off, you know. And when we had this place, I thought, well, he didn't want to go there because it sounded a bit too much like taking a biscuit off your mum and dad.
Yeah.
I'm proud about that. But he stuck it out for quite a while. And I said, look, you're just being stupid. You know, you're spending 600 quid a month on. You could be living with your brother. And so that's all worked out really well. They're happily in there. So, and I can crash on the sofa when I need to come to town. So it's good. I mean, it's very hard to leave London. I lived in New York for 6 years. After the Shoreditch thing, for various reasons, decided to go and have a pop at New York, as you do.
Of course.
I mean, at the time, London's art scene was really just in its infancy. There was Saatchi, who's since been exposed as a bit of a hollow.
Yeah.
See, really. But that was it. And there was a couple of other places, but they were very hard to get to. And... you know, you go to New York and it's like London on double steroids and a turf.
Brilliant.
You know, it was great. I really was turned on by New York massively. Good. And I thought, I've got to go here. And the streets had turned out to be paved with bubblegum, actually, but rather than gold. But I just turned up on a tourist visa, you know, I had been teaching sculpture in an art school down in Portsmouth, and it was like a permanent job, you know. I was only 24.
Nice.
Got to be a full-time lecturer. It was just sort of a job I just accidentally walked into. I mean, it wouldn't happen now. And it was a double-edged sword, really, because I was pretty young for doing that. And art schools are quite, it's like a closeted world all of its own in some ways. And yeah. I did that job for 7 or 8 years. And then I thought, it's like living at home or something, you know, it's too comfortable.
Yeah, yeah.
It is hard work if you're doing it properly. Working in art school is very hard work. It isn't a picnic, because you're dealing with people and their aspirations, and you've got to be responsible about how you work with them.
You know, yeah. You could easily point them in the wrong direction, yeah.
Exactly. You can't do the minimum. You've got to really care.
Yeah.
And it's knackering, you know. I lived in London, and then I did 3 days a week down on the South Coast. And it was absolutely brilliant for me as a young man. You know, I learned much more doing that than I did actually at art school, to be honest with you. Because I learned from the other tutors and the students.
Yeah.
And there were some great students. I mean, Grace from Perry was one of the students when I was teaching there. I'm not going to make any claims about having anything to do with Grayson, because he's completely self-propelled.
Yeah.
I'm not for a moment saying, you know, I had played any part in all that he's done since.
What was that? You said you was his main influence.
That was it, yeah. Blow me. So, yeah, and there were lots of other lecturers going down as well, like Anish Kapoor and people like that. So I'd...
Super.
Unheard of at the time.
Yeah.
So it was really good for me, and I learned a lot from them. But after quite a few years of teaching art, I thought, well, you know, like I say, it's a bit like living with your mum and dad. It sort of looks after you, and I didn't want that. I needed something something a bit more, but push myself, you know. So I just got a ticket to New York and on a tourist visa, and I thought I'd come back in a year. You know, but I ended up staying there
good.
6 years, and I had a couple of kids while we were there as well, just to good measure, you know.
So was your partner, now wife, did you meet her out there, or did she go with you?
She's American. But
oh, super.
We met in London in about, I think it was 1981 or two, I think. When I first moved to London from Bristol, where I was at college, I just got lucky, and there was a huge pie factory around the back of the old Vic Theatre called Greg's, funnily enough, different company.
There you go.
It was empty. It'd been empty for 6-7 years, and it was full of machines and all sorts. It was a great space, 36,000 square feet. It was massive.
Wow.
And the council, Lambeth Council, Labour run at the time, said... One of the people I'd met teaching just asked them, can we use this building for art studios? And they said yes.
So you don't ask, you don't get, do you?
Insane. It's insane. But London was shrinking in the end of the 70s. It was people were leaving, and there was more space. It was easier in a way, but there was no money. There was space, but no money. Now there's money, but there's no space.
Yeah.
You know, you can't have everything. So I after we, there was a massive building that we built an art gallery out of, and we had performances. And, you know, again, I learned so much doing that sort
Brilliant.
Of stuff. That then we moved to Shoreditch when that building eventually got demolished. They were going to knock it down to make old folks' homes.
Yeah.
And if it had been anything else, we probably would have occupied it. Old folks' homes.
Yeah.
Fair play.
Of course.
So we had to move. It was just one night. We all just left, you know, like a succession of vans, you know, just came.
Yeah.
So it was things like that. I've been really lucky in that way, you know, like I can't complain.
Good.
So
knowing your luck, York is going to be the next main art scene, and you get pushed out of that as well.
I don't know. Yeah, possibly. Yeah, well, I'm living here.
I do have questions that I ask each artist, Richard.
Yeah.
How would you explain what you do to someone that doesn't know your work?
I use objects to generate feelings. And I look for an emotional response in what I make.
Yeah.
But hopefully that's followed by a series of thoughts in a person that help them to look at their own life and look at all of us as a group and see what unites us and what keeps us grounded.
Yeah.
So I don't play games about what art is. I'm not particularly interested in figuring out whether this is art or not. I'm more interested in, okay, I use a conventional format of sculpture, which in its purest sense means a single object made out of single material. That's the classical definition. And when I was a kid, I spent a lot of time digging things up and making stuff out of clay just off the riverbank and things like that. So I had a very early sort of love of stuff, you know.
Yeah,
so I was working with stuff. And so for me, materials have a personality and they have associations, you know, whether it's chewing gum or wood or, bronze.
Yeah.
They all bring something. And plastic more recently, I think sculpture has stretched so far now, and I think it's fantastic what's happened in the last, say, just the last 50, 100 years. Almost anything can be sculpture, and that's fine. I'm not saying don't do that. I have done that, and I found that for me, it just got so diffused. I have done lots of installations and different materials and things which are completely impermanent. But over time, you start realizing, well, I've done all this work. I've got absolutely nothing to show for it because, and also there's very little commercial value in a thing which collapses, you know. So I've made an effort to consolidate my thoughts and make them more like a haiku.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Less like a big prose epic, you know, and try to get it down tight. Being concise is really difficult. It forces you to make really sort of careful judgments all the time. And
but it strangely emits more information, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it does.
Yeah.
Because it gives you, if you have a lot of points of reference, it's a bit like a drawing which is sketchy.
Yeah.
You know, you ask the person looking at that drawing to choose the line they want. Whereas for me, that's the artist avoiding the responsibility.
Yeah.
Right, Ryan, in the first place, which is what you're supposed to be able to do. So I think contemporary art particularly demands a huge amount from its audience. And I've always had a problem with that. I think art has to meet its audience, come towards the audience, towards people, bring them to you. And I don't believe in making opaque things which just look interesting because you can't get them, you know.
I want things
which people see and they respond to. And when you think about what a sculpture actually is, it's like a person, because we are things, human beings are stuff.
Yeah.
So when we see a thing, like, I don't know, you're walking down the street, you see a lamppost that's at an angle, it's slightly bent, it looks like it's leaning over, maybe it's tired, maybe it's upset. You might not feel, you know you're doing it, but you're reading that lamppost. So sculpture goes straight to the main switchboard inside a person. You've already responded to it before you even know what you're looking at.
Yeah.
And that really, like, straight under the radar thing is really important to me. So my sculpture is designed to get at you before you've understood that you're looking at a piece of sculpture, and to give you an emotional charge. When you then look at it and you think, well, what is it? Why is it here? And how? And what's it made of? You start asking these questions. Those take you in further into the piece. If you can be bothered, you know, maybe you just want. But first thing is job one. You've got to get someone's attention. If you don't get their attention, then you don't get to play any role at all. So you know, it's important that things have a bit of pizzazz, a bit of chutzpah, but you don't want that to. And you know, neon, whatever gets your attention, but it doesn't necessarily do more than that unless you use it just right. So. So that's it for me, and I honestly believe that art is a huge force for good in all sorts of ways.
Oh, yeah.
Massive. That's why I love it. Because we're, if you like people, if you want to be part of our society, it's, and you like to make things, and you're interested in poetry,
yeah,
it's a great place. All those things seem to come together, you know. So, you know, all those things also have a political meaning as well. And politics and our natural bedfellows, doesn't matter what anybody says.
Yeah, yeah.
And art is a political football to some extent as well. And, you know, the degenerate art exhibitions where the worst art was put on by the Nazis, you know, turns out to be, that's the art we look at now. It's gone. It's absolutely hilarious. So and every time people try to choose what art's acceptable for political reasons, it almost always blows up in the face.
Of course, of course. And well, where you're saying that, I mean, I don't know if you know anything about my story at all.
I do, actually. I've been listening to your work.
There you go. Well, I discovered art in prison, and it's changed my outlook 180 degrees. Mm-hmm. And it's because I was always, as most criminals, you know, very selfish people, just by nature. And yeah, then that made me look at myself in a different way, which then made me look at others in a different way. And then by proxy, it's made me look at the world in a different way, because that's what artists have to do.
Yeah.
And it's just made me a happy person rather than what I was, you know. And
when I went to art school, I thought, I've been told I could draw. I felt comfortable. My mum was a drawer. She's a very good drawer. Watching her and my brothers and sisters do things like that, it drew me into the whole idea of self-expression, or
yeah,
to draw something that looks like the thing you're looking at. You know? Conventional drawing, as I later found out, it was called. I thought it was just called drawing, but
yeah.
So when I went to art school, and they say that doesn't mean anything, you tell them no. All the things that you thought were good, and they just throw them away.
Yeah, yeah.
And you learn that no, it's not like that. It's incredibly difficult to go through that. It's agony, and I found it really difficult to have all this stuff prized out of my hands and just jumped up and down on them together. So it's you go to art school, they take it a bit, and then you spend the rest of your life trying to put yourself back together. So we're all recovering art students.
Yeah.
You know? But it's such a great thing to have happen to you. At the time, it's horrible.
Definitely. Yeah. But when it starts to make sense, that is, as you say, that's the beautiful thing. And I don't know whether that is confidence, I don't know if it's education, whether it's I don't know what it is, but at a certain point the stars just start to align slightly, and you have a little bit of clarity, and you go, that's the direction, that's me, that's the me I've been looking for.
Absolutely. And I think it's really interesting to hear what you went through to get where you are, because you are the polar opposite to me.
Yeah.
You know, I was in a family, I got four brothers and five sisters.
Wow.
So it's a big family, noisy, quite a bit of fighting.
Yeah.
Quite a lot of tantrums and stuff, as you'd expect, and a lot of competition from parents' tension.
Yeah, of course.
As being one of the younger ones, I learned, you know, to get attention, you have to do something that stands out. So that's when I sort of learned, well, if I make this and show it to them, that's nice.
Yeah.
So I learned this reward system, you know, and then to go to art school and have that all just thrown away, it was a very painful experience. but after time, you know, you start to find what you're really about. And I think life experience, it shapes the way you think and feel about things. And,
yeah.
You know, I think for someone who's been through your amazing sort of parabola, and it's incredibly helpful to have a chance to create, to make something new, to make something. It's amazing what they'll do for you and for people that know you, because it's not just the person who's having that experience. It's all the people they know, you know.
Yeah.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Agree. Did you always want to be an artist?
Well, it's funny, you know, because I can't tell you for sure. I knew I wanted to live a life full of feeling, and I sometimes thought that I might like to sing or act or perform in some way, and I soon learned I'm much too shy for that. I don't come across as shy, but actually I'm quite a quiet person when I'm not talking to someone interesting. You know, I let the work speak for me. You know, I don't. This is one of the nice things about art. You don't have to be there. It does it for you. So, but I learned that I wasn't that kind of person. So. I thought about doing architecture or engineering or something, but none of them really felt right. My sister went to art school in York, and I went to visit her, and I walked through the sculpture department, and I just thought, I really like this place. People in there making all sorts of interesting things, I was 16, and I hated school. I didn't get on at school. I left with basically no qualifications, really. I think I had 4 CSEs, which means I turned up. It's like the attendance record, basically. Yeah. You didn't have to do A levels in those days, so I went straight to art school, and I realized after being a bit miserable at school and getting into a lot of fights and stuff, just not fitting in and being the weird one, I found a place where I was like completely at home with all these other people. And I can't tell you what that felt like to me. It was like the sun came out, you know, it really was.
I know exactly where you're coming from.
I feel like that. It's not easy. It's not leisure. People confuse art with leisure. It isn't leisure. So it's difficult. And there's a lot of pressure at art school to be a genius, which is bullshit.
Yeah, especially because there's no direction when you leave there either. Yeah. It's just like opening a sack of helium balloons, isn't it? You know, you sort of just go up in the air and hope that you get gust of wind.
That's a lovely metaphor, actually. It's exactly what it's like. All that sort of power just disappears.
Yeah.
And it floats away, and it's very lonely. It's a very hard thing to do because there's no job. You're on your own, mate. Make your own map, fill it in, and come back to us when you've got it. I think what did it for me as well is just seeing some of, it's not very fashionable now, but at the time when I was a child, my sister won a prize for writing an essay, and she came back with the present. The prize was this book about Michelangelo.
Oh, wow.
And I saw those carvings he did of the slaves in the stone. And they're only half out. And I'd never seen anything like it.
Are they the ones where the shadow has to hit them?
Yeah, and they are.
How amazing is that?
I just thought they're very, I didn't know at the time, but they're very sexy.
Yeah.
Very erotic, and they're very homoerotic. And they've got this amazing, incredible technical perfection, but they're very loose as well. They're amazing things. And I think when I saw them, I thought, wow, as a person in stone that's trying to escape from it, it just really hit me. Yeah, I must have been about 14, I think. And so there was you're just starting to develop a sexual persona. I mean, I'm not necessarily responding to them. I think that the heterosexual, homosexual question is something you're working on at that time.
Life.
And I think there's probably something of that there as well.
Yeah.
And so it was really interesting. And I think that those objects made me realize that a lump of stone can make you feel.
I know.
It's just, you couldn't imagine. So I thought, yeah, that's probably when I decided I wanted to be a sculptor.
Yeah.
That's all I've done ever
Brilliant.
Since.
Well, before I ask any more questions, the artwork behind you, I know no one else can see it. It looks rather like Domus,
yeah,
which is part of the Kensington Chelsea Art Tour. Could you tell us a little bit about that, please?
Yeah. A few years ago, probably about 10 years ago, I was asked to be in an exhibition about found objects. Brilliant. And I have used found things many years ago, but I found I couldn't go anywhere. They didn't work for me. So what I decided to do was find something and then work from it. So I found a crisp packet on the pavement. The technical element aside, I coated it with copper. I electroplated it.
Nice.
So they built up a thickness of metal. So it was made out of copper after that. So it looked exactly like a crisp packet. It was coated in copper.
Brilliant.
So it's like, it suddenly went from being a piece of crap off the street to being an ancient artifact.
Yeah.
Like something from a Roman grave or something. It took on a whole different meaning. And when I was saying earlier about different materials have different associations, taking that thing, and then I did a couple of other things which I gold plated, so they took on this sort of grave goods sort of feel.
Yeah.
And it was that triggered this interest in packaging and things that you find which are discarded. Which, I mean, if you imagine someone from the Roman period finding a Coke can, they'd be absolutely blown away by that. They're worthless, but they are technically the really interesting things. So that the large sort of bag form behind me is something based on one of those empty packets lying on the street, and how they actually, you know, talking about art school, one of the things that art school does for you is it opens your eyes to, you forget about value and you just see thing. You look at something in formal terms, and a crisp packet is a really beautiful object. So shiny sort of silver inside, the graphics on the outside, like tattoos on a body. And it has a figurative feel to it because it's a form, like an envelope, and a human being is an envelope, a skin envelope. So we are a package, we are a vessel. So this idea of a hollow shape, a shape which has no content, it's just a skin. And that, this empty, this thing about something being empty is really interesting to me. So that large cave-like form, it's just basically a massive package that's left lying on the side just here behind me, as if you could crawl into it and spend the night there. And the way when you buy fast food or crisps or whatever it is, you open the packet, you put the crisp inside your body, then the packet is empty. Then you open your car door and you get in your car. Things have been You think about what's happening and you just look at it.
Yeah.
We're putting things inside ourselves. We're putting ourselves inside other things.
Yeah.
We wear the car like a coat. Car says something about you. You eat the thing that you eat because you're hungry, but also because it has a branding on it. So we're a loose amalgam of a loyalties and brand values.
Definitely.
We don't even know we're doing it. We're just working our way through this invisible jungle of products.
Yeah.
So the idea of you put yourself inside a crisp packet, you might have already, you know, it's just echoes about skin, about self, about food, about shelter.
Yeah.
It's all the big chunky things in life, like how do you keep yourself safe and warm? How do you keep yourself fed? Those things are right at the bedrock of humanness, and that's where I feel my subject is mainly to do with what's human, what's synthetic, what's technical, technology and nature inside human beings. So we're natural, but we also make technology, which is synthetic. So we're in the middle of something rather interesting. And the basic human needs of food, sex, warmth. Versus the technical things about how artificial intelligence is developing, how boundaries are dissolving between when you hear the voice on the phone, is it a person or is it a computer? Sometimes for a moment, you're not quite sure.
No.
Boundary that's dissolving.
Yeah.
And also in food that's natural that you can see growing on a tree, or something that comes out of a can or a jar.
Yeah.
Where does the natural part go there? What parts it play? So it's a complicated answer, Gary, I'm afraid, yeah. But I don't find it easy to verbalise because language is my second language, you know?
Brilliant. But there's something so beautiful about taking a lost stroke found object, discarded object, and making someone else aware of that by either discolouring it, taking it out of scale, making it from a different material. But when I first discovered art, one of the first artists that I loved their work was Klaus Oldenburg.
Oh, I'm so glad you said that.
Oh, brilliant.
I really am.
And that he'd done exactly the same, making something hard, soft, or vice versa.
You've hit the nail right on the head there, mate. That, when I was first at art school, when I saw Klaus Oldenburg's soft drum kit.
I was just about to say his soft drum kit. Sorry to shout at you.
It just struck me as so great. I just love that thing. And honestly, that's the day when I sort of felt that sculpture can be almost anything, you know. But it is still one more or less one thing made out of one material. So it does still satisfy that.
Yeah.
A very pure essential form of sculpture, but it's actually done in a completely different way. It's funny, but it's also importantly different. It's not just funny. It doesn't. Yeah. So no, I love Klaus Oldenburg actually. And
good.
I mean, I saw a picture of him actually. I was on Pinterest or something, and he's walking down. I think it's Piccadilly in London, in about it must be mid 60s, and he's got this huge toothpaste tube, holding it around. And he's got this hat, Homburg hat on his head. Yeah. And I just thought, I love this guy. Carry it to the gallery or something himself. Yeah. I don't think he didn't make much money early on, and I think they all sympathise with that. And I just thought, I really like the, when you're in art, you don't have much of a budget. And you end up doing the most preposterous things to try and get stuff to happen on money. And just seeing him do that, I mean, I'm sure you've done the same. You find yourself in a rented van, sort of with no petrol.
Oh, yeah.
In the middle of nowhere. How the hell did I get in this situation?
Yeah. That was last Thursday.
the practical problems. Oh, dear. He's great. I really love his stuff, actually.
But that's the feeling I get. And a friend of mine whose podcast is out this week is Gavin Turk.
Yeah.
And
I've met Gavin a couple of times over the years.
And he's done similar to what you do, and recreate discarded objects he does it in bronze. I didn't see what metal yours was in, but you had, again, like the takeaway parcels. And I thought the tablet blister pack was just stunning, because the more delicate the object, and you know, it being in a hard material, but yeah, making those out of metal as well, superb.
Oh, good, thank you. I mean, I just made them out of clay, and then getting cast stuff done in bronze is expensive, as you know.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
I made a little foundry of my own with a gas cylinder, and my son Ned helped me make this thing, and I was quite surprised how straightforward it turned out to be, just melting the bronze, and it wasn't too bad. And and then I got them gold plated, so we did that one on the cheap actually. But that's you just have to do what you can, you know, with what you have. So I listened to that podcast with you and talking to Gavin Turk. It was really interesting, and I really like his bullshit free, Gavin.
Yeah.
And that's really good. I think it.
That's one of the things that has always appealed to me, is just his honesty in himself and his subject.
Yeah, yeah, and it's the thing about that. Basically, the best artists I really like, they take the work seriously.
Yeah.
But they don't take themselves seriously.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a big difference there, because you do meet people in the art world who have not got that balance.
No.
Let's just put it that way.
Yeah.
And that's what sort of puts you off a bit sometimes. But, you know, it's I think the great thing about Chelsea Art Week is it's really wonderful that they do this and that they're
amazing.
Someone like yourself involved.
Yeah.
It can't be cheap, and it's open-ended in the sense that it could go horribly wrong.
Yeah.
But they've got the right people in charge. I mean, Vestalia's good.
And she's amazing.
Yeah, she's great. She's very professional, and she's very committed. And I think it's wonderful what she's done. It's a hell of a lot of work.
Yeah.
She doesn't seem particularly, like, she doesn't seem worn out by it. She seems to enjoy it.
Well, she's also got a great team behind her as well, you know.
And John Gray as well, he's good.
I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but Kensington and Chelsea is quite a strange old borough of London. Mm. It's got both sides of the economic ladder living cheek by jowl. There will be the extremely wealthy with the, you know, the very poor. The Kensington and Chelsea Art Trail cater for all of those people. And that's what I like. It's bringing the two worlds together, you know?
Absolutely. I think it's brilliant. I think what kills me is that the piece I have on Kensington High Street, the first day I was in there, I noticed a few sort of strange like lines on the top of it. And then I realised people were skateboarding.
Brilliant.
And I thought, oh, I don't mind them doing that. I would just love to see a picture of it, you know, because they obviously do it at night or something. And I thought that was, why not? It's there to... Whatever happens, happens.
Well, you put something on the street, it becomes part of the street, doesn't it? You know, really? It's not yours anymore.
No, it was. I was really happy when John Gray found that spot for me.
Yeah.
Because I don't really like plinths.
Yeah.
I could have put that thing on a plinth, but I don't like plinths. I like something that just looks like it's just there.
Blown in. Someone's
blown in, yeah, exactly.
Thrown it out the car window.
So it was really great that it could be on the pavement, which is where it was made to be. And it's good. I was really
it's
happy.
Not started gathering any rubbish at all, is it?
It things get blown underneath it.
I quite like the idea of that. That it's you know, it's like the other rubbish doing some sort of exodus to the big brother, you know.
King bag, yeah. That's very true. Oh, it's been a really fantastic experience for me, and I love the art bus and everything. And
super,
that was great.
Yeah. And we just spoke about some other artists there. One of the questions that I do have is, if there was you and five other artists, past and present, what would your ideal group show be?
That's a really tricky one. Past and present, okay.
Past or present?
Or present. Well, I'd certainly have always loved Eva Hesse.
Nice.
And she was a massive thing for me when I first encountered her in the 70s. Also, I do love Klaus Oldenburg, I put Klaus in there. Why not? possibly not his soft things, but his he did that project, The Store, where it's a shop window with all sorts of things, cakes and stuff. I thought that was very interesting. The performance work, you know. That's true. There are so many. There's some people I wouldn't put in a show with me because I think probably people, I think if I put my contemporaries in, I don't think that would work so well as people from the past. So I think, funnily enough, I mean, I wouldn't have said this a few years ago, I would say Barbara Hepworth would be an interesting addition. So different and really important female artist who I think I'd never really looked at, a bit like Henry Moore, just sort of brown lumps everywhere and you sort of walk past them and don't pay any attention. But as you get older and you start to, at the time I went to art school, Henry Moore was still considered like a really great leading artist.
Yeah.
And I just thought, piss off, basically. I just thought it was the worst kind of crap ever, you know, but I can see more in it now. And I think Barbara Hepworth, I feel quite so strongly against her, but I do now. I see what she was doing and some of her stuff is absolutely fabulous. So I'd definitely put her in.
Brilliant.
I think I would like to put a painter in, and that would probably be someone you may or may not have heard of, Roger van der Weyden, who's, I don't think so.
It's
not very well known, but he has a piece in Philadelphia Museum of Art, which is this huge triptych just of the Jesus being taken off the cross and given to his mother. And it's so modern looking. It is the most incredible piece of work. If you ever got a chance to see it, it's online, you know.
Yeah.
But it's Roger van der Weyden, and it's called The Deposition.
Brilliant.
And it's just a huge painting as well. And it's done in 1430.
Love it.
It's so old, and it looks so new.
Honestly, yeah.
You wouldn't be surprised if someone told you it was last year.
I love it when that happens.
Incredible thing. And it really blew me off my... In fact, every time I go to Philly, which is where my wife's from, see her family, whatever, I always go and have a look at this thing. It's my old fridge. It's got nothing really to do with what I do, but there's something about it that the way he uses shapes and stuff, it's very sculptural. And religious art, you know, that was the subject for hundreds of years. So his own take on that is really unique.
Yeah. Superb.
Yeah, so, is that enough? I can't remember.
I think so. And what do you think you'd like to be if you wasn't an artist?
That's a really good question. I think the more and more I look at the way things are, the way things are going, and I feel as though the only answer is to be somehow involved in political, in some sort of organization that has a political objective, because there's so much going wrong. I find it really upsetting sometimes if you stop and think about it. How the hell do we get into this situation where the planet's boiling over and no one seems to be doing anything?
No.
It's appalling. It's indulgent to say that and not do anything myself, you know, but
yeah.
What can you do as an individual? We've been told by corporations that it's our fault because our carbon footprint's too big. But it's nothing to do with my carbon footprint.
No.
It's your fucking corporation.
Yeah.
It's been put on us, and it isn't us. I just feel as though, why aren't we hearing more about that sort of thing? You know,
I think all you can do as an artist is, like you just said, being a part of something and sort of hold hands with another artist who's holding hands with another artist. And that's, I think, all you can do.
Yeah.
And when you're around people like that, and I'm only on the fringes of it, you know, I'm not a sort of active activist myself. When I sort of met up with them, it does give you that, it gives you that little something that it's not all bad. There are people trying really hard to make a change, you know?
Just going back a couple of years to the anti-Brexit march in London, going on that was hugely calming, because you thought, well, there's a lot of people here with the same viewpoint about that. And I mean, I've always said I'm a European from Yorkshire.
Yeah.
That's the way I see myself. And I don't see why that had to change. It has done. I think that's been a massive problem, and I'd love to have been able to do something about that, but we're stuck with it now. So, but I agree with you that some art can be too obviously political. And for me, the best, it's like those posters from the Soviet Union with people marching. It socialist realism, it just turns you off. But when I talk about what I do in a tiny little way, changing someone's perspective on value and what the correct proportion of we should all have each of what we have as a country, rather than a few people having most of it and the rest of us making do with what's left. It, you know, it's not that difficult to figure out what's wrong.
No.
It's getting something to change is just, I sometimes just think, yeah, maybe if I wasn't an artist, maybe I'd do that, but I don't think I'd be very good at it. And I'm going to stick to art, to be honest with you.
But then you can just make artwork alongside someone that is good at it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, so it sticks a lot, doesn't it?
Actually, because your interviews reveal things. And I think that's part of what it's opening eyes. Opening people's eyes is the main thing. And so they can see the structures behind all the bullshit.
Yeah, just make people look at things from a different angle and see things that they hadn't done before, which is what art is all about, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Have you got anything else coming up at the moment?
I've got a show. I'm in a group show in Germany at the end of the year. And when I get this space finished, I'm going to have, I don't know what, something. So that'll be, it'll be sculptures. And I'm really looking forward to having a big party in here, actually. It'll be good.
Excellent. And how old is that studio?
I've only had it since January.
And oh, brilliant. It's
full of old junk and stuff. So I've been a hell of a lot of clearing out to do. So
excellent.
It's getting there now.
So you're still floating about finding new things in there?
Yeah, I am actually. Yeah, it's quite interesting.
Where can anyone find what you do, be it website or social media?
My website is richardmcness.com. And I have an Instagram account, which is at richardmcness.
Brilliant. Well, Richard, that's all my questions asked. Thank you very much for your time.
Yeah. Nice to talk to you, Gary. It's a great, great project you've got there.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
I'll speak to you soon. Ta-da.
Hello, I'm Vasalia Chilton, the director of Kensington Chelsea Art Week and Art Trail. The artist you've just been listening to is part of the Kensington Chelsea Art Week and Art Trail. The Art Trail starts on the 18th of June and ends on the 31st of August. You can find all the details on our website, kcaw.co.uk. Thank you so much for listening.
Well, hope you enjoyed that episode of the Ministry of Arts podcast. So we wasn't dictated to by advertisers, we decided from the offset to go ad-free, which means obviously we had to self-fund. So we set up the Ministry of Arts Patreon page. And without that support, we would not be able to produce this podcast. So if you like what you hear and you're able to support the podcast, just go over to the Ministry of Arts Instagram profile. You'll find a Linktree drop-down box, which will direct you straight to our Patreon page. And for the price of a cup of coffee, you can help keep us growing week by week. But if you're not able to do that, that's fine, because this content is free for everyone. But leaving a review on whichever platform you listen to your podcast, that really does help us get noticed and anyone else looking for an art podcast. Or even giving us a positive shout out on your social media. Everything is appreciated. But either way, thanks for listening. And until next week, ta-da.
This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.